Jerry, you've been in sustainability, and of course you were involved way back with being able to bring through peaceful resolution towards the current situation that has continued from nuclear free, getting New Zealand to become nuclear free, and also to be aware of the ramifications of, I presume, of a nuclear winter. And so you brought all the engineers together to see how we could work from that standpoint to bring about positive change. Can you take it from there for me?
Well, when we started the group, Engineers for Social Responsibility, back in 1983, the nuclear threat was a big one, and that was one of our main issues. But we called the group Engineers for Social Responsibility because there's a lot of other issues apart from the nuclear issue, and over the years, the nuclear issue has receded a little into the background, still not completely, but other things have come to the foreground, like, as you mentioned, climate change and peak oil. So that's where we're focusing a lot of our attentions at the moment. I've got a couple of worries at the moment, and they're both in that area of climate change and peak oil. I'm probably more concerned about peak oil, but I think both of them are pretty critical.
Yes, well, we need to be able to have more debate in the public arena on that. Can you give us your understanding, Jerry?
Well, on climate change, I think there's a lot of people, they hear the media sort of giving a balanced viewpoint to both the opposers and the people who say that climate change is happening, and they begin to wonder whether it's really true. There's a story, if people who've got children remember it, called The Lion in the Meadow by Margaret Mahe. And if you remember, it's all about a boy who is playing in the meadow, and he comes running in saying, "Mummy, there's a lion in the meadow." And she says, "Don't be silly, little boy. There's no lion in the meadow." And he goes out again and comes running in a minute later saying, "Mummy, there really is a lion in the meadow." And so she makes up a story about a dragon in the matchbox and says, "Here's a dragon. If you go out in the meadow, the dragon will scare the lion away." And so he goes out into the meadow. Then he comes running back a minute later, followed by a lion, saying, "Mummy, there's now a dragon in the meadow as well." And so the moral of the story is that even if you don't believe a story and you make it up, it doesn't mean it isn't true, and it won't cause you some grief. So it's a nice little analogy for the climate change story. And of course, we've got both a lion and a dragon in our lives. We've got the lion, which is climate change, and the dragon, which is peak oil. And they're both snapping at our heels. So we're into some big changes ahead if we don't get our act together.
Yes, this is the general consensus with a lot of people that I know. And of course, the difficulty has been is that from time to time somebody pops up out of the woodwork and puts an opposing viewpoint in. And as you say, the media gives a so-called balanced report when in actual fact it's skewered, and a lot of the skeptics, regrettably, are using what I would say is not very valid science, and yet this is what's the problem in New Zealand now. We've still got, say, the Federation of Farmers still thinking that climate change is not a problem.
Well, I guess there's always been cyclical fluctuations in the climate, but there's overwhelming evidence that at the moment human-induced climate change is on top of that. So it could be the tipping point. It could be pushing us over the edge. I'm no expert on climate change. I can only make up my mind based on what I read and see. But I believe that we're in for a significant thing. But there was a report came out in the UK a while ago by Stern talking about whether we can actually do anything about climate change within our economic capacity, and he concluded with all his report team that yes, we could do something about it, and it was within our capacity to do so. But what he didn't seem to take into account was the fact we're also battling peak oil, and peak oil, for those of the listeners who aren't familiar with it, is the concept that we might have used up half of our available oil resources around about now. And what this means, of course, is that, I mean, oil only really came on stream about 150 years ago. So in the last 150 years, we've sort of started from a zero base, and we've used up half of it now. And what that's done is really increased the carrying capacity of the planet, in an artificial way. So people think, yeah, sure, we've got plenty of energy. We can put energy into our fields, grow more crops, and that increases the carrying capacity of the planet. But it's a false illusion, really. So we've got to work out how we're going to get out of that trap, as well as climate change.
Yes, because everything's based on growth. The corporates in particular are wanting to have a big percentage of you know, profit taking for the next year or the next quarter. And so with the population now sort of mushrooming at the same time and everybody into consumerism and now the fall off of oil, we're going the wrong way.
Well, you mentioned in your introduction that I'm Maori from Ngāi Tahu, which is the South Island tribe, Sitipuni, Aurigan, etc. So when Maori think about sustainability, they think, and yes, I am aware that Maori did make the Maa more extinct, but Maori do have a concept of sustainability which is intergenerational. So we think about sustainability in terms of at least seven generations. If you're thinking about yourself, there's the concept of your own children, your own great-grandchildren and their grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, and then you may also have your grandparents and your great-grandparents alive at the same time. So there's a seven-generational aspect right now. And that's, I think, something worth bearing in mind. The average company probably thinks, in terms of its next annual return, annual balance sheet, it doesn't have a long-term horizon, and politicians don't have a long-term horizon either. They're thinking about the next election. So that's why you also mentioned in your intro that we need to get the politicians on board so that we start thinking in conjunction with each party, not just as a single party scoring points.
Yes, there are a lot of challenges around this, and of course New Zealand is a young country, and it's also in many ways nimble. We feel that we're, what I'd say, a clever country in many ways. I mean, the fact is that number 8 wires really sort of built a lot of genius out of New Zealand, and so how do we basically mobilise consciousness throughout New Zealand, Jerry? I know you're working with engineers who, of course, build a lot of the heavy structures from roads, bridges, and buildings. Have you some input on this?
Well, I think engineers are probably going to be important because we're going to be the technology makers that are going to get us out of the mess. But there's a tendency to rely on technology to solve all the problems. I've had people say, if we run out of oil, technology will solve the problems. Well, sometimes we don't always solve the problems. Sometimes the problems are too big. I remember when I was just after graduating 40 years ago, the idea was that we'd have fusion power, you know, based on the hydrogen bomb, but contained within a little plasma so that we had unlimited energy. Well, 40 years later, we still haven't got that working. So you can't rely on things happening when you want them. Sometimes there's quite a big time lag. But yes, engineers are going to be crucial to this. And so what we were trying to do for engineers was to make them more aware of the size of the problem, the scope of the problem, what sort of decisions they make that have an influence on that. And of course, engineers are all about production. I mean, we deal a lot with infrastructure, but essentially engineers are behind producing the goods that we use in our daily lives. And so we can be responsible for a lot of the consumerism that's going on. I don't know whether you have bought something at one of the big hardware stores lately, but you can buy incredibly cheap stuff from China. But when it breaks down, you throw it away and you buy another one because, A, it's so cheap, it's not worth repairing. But all this ends up in the landfill. We're distributing our resources of the earth, diluting it, and putting it back into landfills. They're going to be the mines of the future, I think. But yes, engineers are the key to a lot of it, but we're not miracle workers. Some things have to be done by decision makers, so we need to educate the decision makers to how to do it.
I agree, and I think this is a conundrum that we're in at present. We, at heart, everybody wants change, and we have elected servants in Wellington, and in many cases, lots of people are sending emails, people are phoning, and particularly having groups of people go and talk with their MPs to encourage them to show that they've definitely got an interest in what's happening in Wellington. And I guess it's to be able to really have a critical mass on that as well, to really get everybody in Wellington to take heed to what change needs to come and be put in place.
Well, I'm heartened by Helen Clark's statement last year to the Labour Party conference about becoming carbon neutral, because even though it was a fairly sweeping statement and some people thought it was a bit facile, it does indicate that the government's putting it up there as a top priority, and I think that's really good. I think the danger is that the National Party decides that they will try and knock her off her pedestal, but this issue is too important to be a party political issue. It really has to be a combined effort. We're really on a war footing in a way with sustainability. One of the things is that if we run out of we won't run out of oil, but we're going to have to start prioritising what we use it for. And at the moment, we're using about half of it for things like transport, which is great if you're in the business of travelling. And in a country like New Zealand, where we're spread out over 1,000 kilometres, you need a car, you need transport. But we've got to start looking at public transport more. We've got to start looking at renewable fuels. But whatever happens, we aren't going to have business as usual. Even if we could make all the biofuels to keep our car fleet going, it's not going to keep us going into the long term, because we need that ground for food. We can't just use it up for growing corn to make ethanol for biofuels. And we can't use even the byproducts from our meat industry like tallow for biofuels, because they've got alternative uses. We can't be using food products for our motive power. So it's going to be a real problem. But the real trick is to get all of the political parties aligned together. That's the Greens, Labour, National.
It is, and it's going to be a major trick, definitely, to be able to see if we can hammer out some sort of consensus.
I don't think we have to convince the Greens about it. They're certainly on board. And Helen Clark has indicated the Labour Party is on board, and the National Party have got their own policy, their blue-green policy. So all we have to do is get them all to sing from the same song sheet.
Yes, of course, the carrot is that business still wants to carry on. Businessmen don't want to see themselves having to cut back. They always have had the mantra of growth, growth, growth. And I realise there's a limitation on Spaceship Earth. We can only produce so much before it comes back at us. And I guess this is the, should we say, the exhaust of CO2 in the ventilation system of the spaceship, for one way of putting it, is the fact is that we cannot actually live and breathe in that sort of atmosphere.
Well, we've always had this mantra about getting back into the top 10 of the OECD countries. I can't understand why they insist on that, because growth, just for the point of view of more and more consumer goods, isn't really growth at all. Growth is something about the quality of life. And it may mean that you make higher quality goods. You may make less of them. You might make them better to last longer. But it's a different way of looking at things. I think we've got to start remeasuring what we mean by growth. And economic growth in itself, or growth in GDP, isn't really the total answer. We've got different ways of measuring it.
I agree. It's like if you're going to have your house situated in an area where there's possibly flowing water, there's a lot of bird song, but the children are very, very relaxed and they have plenty of other children to play with in a very safe environment, then, as you say, the way of life becomes more enjoyable, particularly if people in the local houses are interrelating and sharing, be it food across the fence or definitely moving within the community from house to house and be it parties or whatever. That, of course, then makes it far more an enjoyable way of life compared to possibly just having a whole lot of material things.
Well, I think no one likes to sit in a car for an hour a day travelling to and from work. And, I mean, my daughter used to live out at Kadi Kadi in Auckland, but she found that the petrol costs and the travel time costs were just getting exorbitant. Now she's moved down to Wellington, which is good. But in the long run, we've got to start thinking about how we live in cities. The idea that we live out and commute for an hour in a car on our own isn't sustainable at all. It's more sustainable to travel by public transport. But even so, we're going to have to start thinking about whether we really want to have lifestyle blocks in the country and use our productive land that way. Someone mentioned to me recently that if you want to get into a new industry in the future, maybe the house moving business might be a good way, where you move the houses back from the country and put them on a smaller block in the city. Or maybe you get into the horse business. But being more serious, I think we've got to start looking at the way we design our cities. The apartment boom's taken off, but we're still not really designing cities to be livable without cars. We've got to start doing more about how people are going to exist, not just in the next 3 years, but the next 20 years, the next 50 years. I mean, some cities in Europe, 1,000 years old, 5,000 years old, and they still are usable in the way in which they were designed all that time ago. New Zealand has to start thinking more long-term.
With Curitiba in Brazil, of course, there is a template, but of course there's no real city starting from scratch. So that if all the infrastructure is put in place in possibly an underground or a monorail as a feature part of it, and then how big should a city be? Is 1 million people in one area too many people? Do we have big green belts in between certain suburbs so that people can feel as if they're more in tune with nature?
I think in New Zealand, cities tend to grow like Topsy, really. Look at, say, Flatbush in Auckland. You get a piece of ground, you think people buy sections out there because they're cheap, and they build up houses on them which because they want affordable housing. But there's no services, there are no... there's no public transport, and then bus services are put in to meet the demand. But in the meantime, people have to use cars, share cars, or use their own car. It's quite a drain on services. We don't plan urban developments very well. They sort of develop, and then we try and meet the needs. It's that meet the demands, provide, and so on. But it's not working. We have to do a little bit more planning, but we've kind of flown away from central planning. Anything which smacks of central planning is anathema to the market economy.
Yes, I've mentioned this previously before. I was up in China not so long ago in the city of Shenzhen, not too far from Shanghai, and they had built a large pyramid, and this pyramid was all of glass, and it was the same shape as Teotihuacan, the Temple of the Sun in Mexico. It was a huge, huge pyramid. And I was very intrigued, so I went and wanted to have a look. And I went inside, and there was an area the size of a full indoor basketball court that was the actual city plan. It was all made in 3D. And they had all the roads, all the canals, all the trees, all the buildings, all put in place as to how they were going to develop their city. And then they had this huge glass see-through bridge that went right across the middle of this court, for want of a better word, and all the Chinese people were thronging in there, and there were thousands, and they were enthralled that they could actually see where they were going in the future. They could see this magnificent city that was part water and park trees, roads, etc. And they saw it. They really got it that that's where they were going. Now, we just don't do anything like this in New Zealand. I actually haven't seen anything in the West to that extent for them to put down virtually half an acre of a plan in 3D of one's future city.
In Wellington, we did have a model of the city, a proper model, but it was more designed for sort of wind studies than anything else, not as a template for the future. But we don't have to build physical models anymore. I mean, we can do it virtually on computers. But the town planners, and I'm not very familiar with that profession, but I'm sure that they could be persuaded to try and do something as long as someone was willing to have the confidence to go down that route. You're right, we haven't planned a new city recently in New Zealand, but perhaps we have to start replanning our existing cities from scratch, and especially in terms of transport. We can't keep on building roads. I sometimes like to think of the last Roman emperor who built the last Roman road, what it must have been like, because the Romans had a great system of roads. They had a system of about the same length of roads in Rome as there is in China at the moment, freeways. So at some stage or other, something happened and they built the last Roman road. Well, one day we'll build the last road for fossil fuel-powered vehicles. But those roads will still be useful as routes and corridors, but they may not be used for roading. And we're moving in that direction. We're starting to think of land transport as a whole, not just as cars. Last week we talked about, or heard about on the news, that they're talking of merging transit with Land Transport New Zealand. Now, transit is a road-focused organisation, whereas land transport has a brief for the wider transport situation. So hopefully something will come out of that for the good.
Definitely, yes. Could you? We're just not hearing you quite so loud, Jerry. If you could speak up a little more, that'd be lovely. Yes, well, you see, Auckland at the moment is supposed to be the second city on Earth that has got the most asphalt and road down. Jeanette Fitzsimmons mentioned it some years ago that Houston and Texas had more roads and asphalt than any other city, and Auckland was number two. And so, of course, this is a big problem if you have rain as well. The rain's not actually going into the ground, it's going onto roofs, it's going onto roads, so then it's going to be piped down to stormwater and overflowing into the sea. And so there's the problem, of course, in the future that we may have all this road with, we might be able to dig them up and have sort of gardens on top of them.
Well, a road's always going to be useful as a... People are still going to have to travel around, even if they're walking or cycling or using sustainable transport or public transport. We just may not need six lanes of motorway. But people will always have a need for transport. It's just a question of how the transport's done. And the idea of driving around in our SUVs or our cars with one person in is probably going to be seen as unsustainable. I like to think about, you know, what's your great-great-grandchildren going to say when she hears that you burnt up all the oil in a couple of generations? Now, they may have their own transport means in that time, but, I mean, sustainability is all about allowing future generations to have the freedom of choice that present generations have. And so burning up non-renewable resources now, without knowing what's going to replace them, is a little bit irresponsible.
I think Al Gore talked about a moral imperative, that we must look at things not only from an economic, but are we ethically able to do such a thing as take away our children's future? And this is definitely an important issue facing us. So how do we get into schools to allow children to realise that we want them to help us shape our collective future?
Well, I think the children today are a lot more aware, certainly than I was when I was at school. They do see things in a different way. There was a Digital Earth Conference in Auckland last year, which had quite a youth component to it. And, in fact, there's another one the week after next in San Francisco, a follow-on from that, to which my son's going, plus quite a contingent of New Zealand youth. So I think young people are more attuned to it already. But like a lot of things, we need to get into the schools to do it. Now, the question is whether the teachers that are in schools have the capacities and the resources to do it, or whether They need to get outsiders to do it. We talked about government before, but I'm just wondering whether the government needs to think about maybe having a ministry for sustainability. They've got a ministry for the environment. They've got a Department of Conservation. They've got a Ministry of Economic Development. But sometimes you need to merge things and focus on the important thing, which is sustainability. And that could have a function also of education, educating for sustainability. So there could be some way in which the government can restructure the key departments so that sustainability takes top priority.
Yes, and to be able to integrate all these departments. I know that I've heard many, many stories about each department in Wellington is a silo and doesn't really know how to communicate with other departments when in a sort of a holistic system, or when you take systems theory into account, there is more flow of information. I mean, sometimes it'd be lovely to have each department having lunch with the other counterpart and other departments so that everybody knows what's going on.
Maybe after the next election, the government could revert back to what they did in 1984 when the Labor government came back after quite a time in the wilderness, and they had an economic summit and a technology summit. So perhaps after the next election they could have a sustainability summit and try and get all the thinkers in New Zealand and maybe even a few from overseas and try and get the best thinkers to concentrate on this problem. It's how long's that away? It's 18 months away. It's something that could be started to be planned for now.
However, if the government was savvy, going by sort of this week's polls, they should get this going within the next 6 months so that they can actually show that they have still got a vision for tomorrow. That would be even smarter of them.
Well, I guess the government always assumes they're going to get back in power, so there's no reason why the planning for that can't start now. I certainly know that sustainability and carbon neutrality is the buzzwords down here in Wellington, the Prime Minister's Department and wherever. So maybe they are planning that. Perhaps we just have to put that pressure on them. But it is one of the major issues of the day, I think.
I agree. We all agree on that one, Jerry. Yes.
And the other thing is we've got to really make sure that we use the time we've got, use the fossil fuel we've got to make the transition to renewables possible, because it's not going to be done overnight. If you think back to the 70s and the oil shocks when they used to have careless days and they reduced the open road speed limit down to 80 kilometres an hour, the United States and all of the developing countries put a huge amount of research into how can we use less oil, and they put a lot of time and effort into it. And when you look back at that time and look at the way in which the demand curves were increasing, you can actually see a dent in the curve. You can see that they actually, all that research was productive. It produced a slowing of demand. And so the message you get from that is that if you put enough effort into it, it does pay off. So we need to start now putting that effort in, not purely in terms of energy efficiency, but in terms of how can we use how can we buy time? How can we get the benefits of fossil fuels to help us make that transition away from a plastics and transport-dominated society to a sustainable, renewable society? It means a total change in the way we live. It means we're going to have to get away from things like globalization down to something in a more regional scale. And New Zealand, as you mentioned before, is really in a good position. We're self-sufficient in fuel and food, self-sufficient in fuel if we took coal into account. But we can't just use it as if it's business as usual.
Yes, it sort of. Lots of people who I have spoken to recently have this frustration that the media sort of throwing up the information, but they're not actually putting strategies in place. They're not actually calling in smart people to be able to put out a scenario for tomorrow, throw up some sort of blueprint. There could be obviously a page or two in the New Zealand Herald every Saturday, or the Dominion every Saturday, that says, okay, let's have a look at different scenarios for the future and see what it would take to put them in place or at least get feedback.
That's right. Some of the overseas papers, such as The Guardian or The Independent, they've got writers who specialise in this topic. There's a George Monbiot, mm-hmm. writes for The Guardian, and I mean he gets people's backs up, but he certainly gets people's attention because he was the one who talked about food miles for New Zealand and how he wouldn't buy New Zealand kiwi fruit. But I mean he's got some good ideas as well. So you need some investigative journalists who can take the facts and then follow them on with opinion pieces that says this is maybe the way we should go. Get some debate going. At the moment it's kind of one-sided.
I agree, as to be able to initiate these new ideas, novelty and elegance with it. I feel that we still may be able to, we'll have to be more simple at the same time. And as you agreed, we cannot just go on and have everybody in New Zealand have two 42-inch plasma TV screens in their house. We'll have to find other ways to curtail our consumerism, and yet, of course, you're going to get certain interests in the community that don't want it, and particularly, of course, the business community who govern on sales, who are most probably in debt at the moment and are basically planning on a lot of consumer products being sold so that they could actually pay off their present debt. They won't be happy with this type of thought.
Well, I think there's a lot of opportunities in the change. The last week's listener was talking about green opportunities. And California, they're doing the same thing. They're talking about businesses taking advantage of the fact that people need to buy solar hot water systems or whatever. There are lots of opportunities around. So it's not entirely doom and gloom. But it's really the way we go about it, and we need to start doing it now. And just try and pick some of the low-hanging fruit around in terms of what's the first thing we should be doing. Focus on the big areas where we're using lots of non-renewable resources. I mean, transport's a big one. Waste is another one. The amount of waste we generate in New Zealand. There was a program last night on TV1 about a woman who's living her green values, recycling as much as she can. If you recycle an aluminium can, you save 95% of the energy that it was originally made with. And of course, you save the materials. So recycling is good as long as it's done sensibly. We don't have the facilities in New Zealand to recycle a lot of things, but that's something that could grow. We don't need to dispose of, say, laptops and cell phones every 3 years. They could be repaired. They could be upgraded. As you remember the old days, we had computers with motherboards that you put a new motherboard in, and it was good for another 3 years. But now, the way things have been developing, we just throw them away, put them in the landfill. It's not sustainable.
We've got a problem too with trucks. The railways are not efficient at the moment, and I've always maintained if we brought the Germans into New Zealand and had them run the railways, it would become efficient very, very quickly. But a lot of truckies or a lot of business people who want goods taken from point A to point B find that a truck is far faster than sending it to a railroad where it might sit for a day or two and then go on the railway line to the destination and then have another truck pick it up and take it to its final destination. So quite often that could be a 3 to 5 day event, whereas a truck can do it overnight. And so these are the arguments that are put to us. So I guess, again, it's like, why have we allowed our train services to become so backward, when in actual fact anyone who was smart would have realised that to have dual tracks to every major city would be a major priority.
I think the rail business and the truck business, they've got their own lobbyists, and both are good for certain things. Like rail is good for hauling bulk product long distances. And one of the things that Auckland needs is it needs a lot of aggregate to build things, concrete, roads and what have you. And they're running out of aggregate in Auckland, so that they've got to get it from further and further afield. Now, at the moment, most of it comes by truck. But there's no reason why that couldn't be, because it's not a just-in-time product. You can stockpile it at either end. So that's the sort of thing that rail could be used for. Another project I was aware of last year was a proposal to, apparently they ship wood chips down from Northland down to Kawerau to make a certain sort of paper. It's got to be a certain sort of fibre. And that was all coming down by truck. And now they're proposing to use the rail for that. So it is possible to do the mixing and matching of rail and road. And, I mean, Toll is an example where they run both road and rail in their own company. So it's the question of looking beyond traditional economics into the long term.
Yes, I know of an example of we're getting cheap coal from Indonesia transported into Tauranga, and then trucking it from Tauranga to Huntly, where underneath the ground, of course, there's millions of tons of coal, which is not quite up to standard, but they still burnt this Indonesian coal in Huntly, when in actual fact, even railway lines go from Tauranga through onto the main trunk line. So there are all these peculiarities, and so how do we get a brainstorm to pull these all together?
Well, you mentioned silo mentality, and that's a typical example, I guess, of silo mentality, in that the power company wants coal so they can import it themselves. Solid Energy wants to mine coal and sell it, but they'll export it overseas. So we import 25% of New Zealand's coal needs from Indonesia, and then we export a lot of coal to Japan and China. So this trans-Tasman or trans-world globalization doesn't always work in the most efficient way, in the sense that you get white goods coming across from Australia to New Zealand. We send white goods from New Zealand to Australia, or we make them in Australia and New Zealand factories. This sort of churn is not efficient. You know, it's the whole question of globalization, where you move your product around to where the labor's cheapest and make it there. It's good for the country where the manufacturing happens, but for the country where the manufacturer is lost to, they lose the skills, they lose the income. I once talked to a taxi driver in Auckland who used to pick up all the people at a shirt manufacturer, Summit Shirts, and they closed the factory down, and he thought, you know, it's all very well for able to buy a cheap shirt that's made in China, but then I've lost a chunk of my income because of that. So people have to be aware that there's winners and losers. They're not always the same people.
I agree. It's a difficult one for all us to be involved in and actually think responsibly as to how we can take care of our tomorrow. So
I think we perhaps just need to get just change our way of thinking a little bit, so we get a conservation mentality in place. So we need to think about conserving materials and energy, buying products that are going to last a long time. When we buy a power tool, we buy one that it may be a bit more, it might be $100, but at least it's going to last and be passed on to your children. We've got to think about quality versus quantity, and we've got to think about what really adds to our well-being apart from GDP.
Yes, because that's a difficult one. The expediency is such that you want to do some drilling in your house, and it's not a big job. You go down to the local supermart, and you can pick a good drill up for $20, and you know it'll do the job, and if it doesn't work, go next year, that's okay. All you needed at the moment is a one specific job. This is where people will take the shortcut, and And how do we get around that? Because a lot of people say, well, you're not going to control what I buy. And so this is where I think you've got to have government and cross-party agreements to allow only certain things to come into the country. I mean, this is a whopper.
It may be even possible to have some sort of changes to the way in which you tax things. So you tax things that have a life that's less than the expected life for a certain sort of product. Probably an administrative nightmare, but the idea that you sort of you can add to your GDP by having a whole lot of throwaway items. If you make things that you throw every year, your GDP goes up rather than having things that last 5 years. It's a nonsense, really. Talking about expediency, I remember that the lesson I had very early on about buying quality goods was when I had to dismantle a car and I needed a wheel puller, and I bought about three which broke before I bought a good quality one which lasted. I think I've still got it somewhere. So it pays to buy quality if you can afford it, but sometimes you can't.
Yes, well, you see, the other thing, of course, the World Trade Organization will say to a country, now, you cannot put taxes on certain things that you're importing in there into your country because you're breaching the code. And so we have to also unloosen the shackles from the World Trade Organization, and unbeknown to most New Zealanders, the New Zealand government has actually signed up to this agreement, which makes it... defers to the World Trade Organization virtually on every instance when it comes to trade in and out of a country.
Well, New Zealand's lowered its trade barriers. They were one of the first countries to do that. It probably hasn't made a lot of difference. It's given us a lot of imported products. But I think someone somewhere has to take the initiative in a lot of things, and I think New Zealand is ideally placed to take the initiative in moving towards sustainability. We did it in nuclear-free, getting back to the thing we started talking about in this program. And I think New Zealand could be a world leader in terms of making the transition. We're an island state. We can do things. As you said, we're very nimble-footed. We've got the surplus to try and do it. If New Zealand can't do it, then there are very few countries that can. And so New Zealand could be the ideal laboratory for showing that sustainability is possible.